Listen now to a talk Glenn Hirsch had with Dr. Robert Ross, professor of pediatrics at the Wayne State University School of Medicine in Detroit, Michigan. They covered the 2015 trading guidelines for pediatric cardiology fellowship programs.
Well, thank you for joining us today in the Axel studio, Dr. Ross.
Thank you for inviting me.
And maybe you can start by telling us, since this is a revision, why the need for a revision?
About 4 years ago, the Joint Council of Congenital Heart Disease approached me in my role then as the president of the Society for Pediatric Cardiology Training Program Directors to look at revising the original guidelines. They came out initially in 2005, and there's been a lot of changes in our field since then, not only in the content of what we teach, but also in the way we evaluate the trainees. We then took it upon ourselves, the board of the SBC-TPD, to then enlist experts across the country in each of the subspecialties to look at the original guidelines and then update them.
Great. And, you know, a lot of our listeners know that COCATS 4 just came out this year for the adult training programs. Was there any overlap with the American College of Cardiology or the COCATS group when writing your guidelines?
It was interesting that when we started out, we did not approach the college or the other partners from the original sponsorship, which were the American Heart Association and the American Academy of Pediatrics. But as we were going along, we realized that we would be able to utilize their extensive guideline expertise. And in particular, the American College of Cardiology was very helpful in guiding us through the process of getting these guidelines in the kind of shape that they need to be in to be published. And we worked closely with them over the last year, I would say, to achieve this publication coming out now.
It sounds like, in just looking over the document, there are 8 specific task forces that are covered, whether it's general cardiology, imaging, critical care, EP. Maybe you can talk about some of the most important changes that have occurred since the previous version.
Right. Well, the biggest change was that we added a new task force, and that was a combination of heart failure, transplant, and pulmonary hypertension. We grouped those as one task force as having some overlap, but those were not subjects covered in the original documents. And clearly, the field in all of those subspecialties has advanced dramatically over the last decade with the assist device available now and made in sizes that are useful for even infants, as well as the advances in pulmonary hypertension with the oral medications that have really allowed our patients to do well over time. In addition, we had long discussions among the task force chairs as to the format of the guidelines relative to the original format. And about the same time we were starting on this, there was this big push to start to change the way we teach, train, and evaluate our fellows. And there was a set of activities called entrustable professional activities, or EPAs, that we kind of came the buzzword of the teaching mode. So we kind of had to hold back on some of our writing just to figure out how best to incorporate this new technology in describing what we were going to do. And we learned quite a bit about that, and were able to incorporate the EPAs in these new guidelines. And what they said was they're actually graded on a 5-point scale from novice to expert. And we really wanted the fellow to get to a level 4, which says that the fellow may act independently on graduation to do each of the EPAs. And at the same time, the curriculum was going to be stated within each task force chapter so that they would know what they had to achieve to be able to get to this level of competency.
Was there any implementation of the ACGME milestones into the document?
Yes, there was. And, you know, that was another important advance in that not only were these EPAs delineated both for all subspecialties within pediatrics, but then an additional group of them were delineated for the specialty of pediatric cardiology, and we had great input into those details. And then each task force then delineated the milestones that the fellows could aim for to achieve competency in each of these activities. The other big change that we instituted was the original set of guidelines listed a minimum number of procedures and time that must be spent in each subspecialty to successfully complete graduation and sit for the boards. And we took the approach that that absolute number for all fellows was not practical because so many people are going into their own subspecialties upon graduation. And it's not really practical to have a person going into, say, electrophysiology needing to do 500 echoes, perhaps. So what we decided upon was to require a minimum number of procedures to allow those evaluators from the programs to have enough data to be able to then counsel the fellows as to where they stand relative to their peers vis-a-vis these milestones, so that they may say, well, you've done these number of procedures and you still need to do more because, you know, you're not at the level that we would like you for your year of training. Or at the other end of the spectrum, they may do these minimum numbers and show proficiency so that they can then go on to other areas of training.
Was there any area that was focused on within the guidelines of a minimum expectation? For example, in the COCATH 4, they essentially state that every adult cardiology trainee should be proficient in echocardiography. Now, if someone's going to be a basic scientist and they're not going to be doing clinical work, then that's up for debate and a discussion. However, otherwise, they expected that everyone would have that as a core skill. Were there any type of skills like that in the guidelines that were expected as a bare minimum?
Yes, I think each task force had bare minimums for their particular field. And of course, each one of them thought that theirs was the most important. So we had to do a lot of work to try and get some uniformity across the board. But I think, like in the adults, you know, echo is very important, as is cath. And what we determined was that even if you're not going to do cardiac catheterizations, you still need to know the indications, the risks, the benefits, the potential complications, how to look at the data and interpret it correctly, whom to refer and when to refer, and all those aspects, even if you're not going to actually be doing the procedure. So there are certain core minimums to complete the core fellowship for each of the task forces.
In just reviewing this, it looks like the task forces, all eight of them, could be updated over time individually so that it doesn't require an entire rewrite of the guideline. How did you plan on doing that?
Yeah, I think that's an important point. Each of these task force documents is a standalone piece of work so that if there are more changes in one particular subspecialty, for instance, adult congenital is undergoing a rapid change as they now have their own board and may have an examination down the road, we can then edit these much easier than redoing the whole process from beginning to end.
Well, it sounds like this was an important document, especially with all the technological changes that have occurred since the previous version. Not only the technology and medicine and the devices, as you mentioned, but also just the educational advances, if we call them that, with the ACGME and the milestones, and how do you incorporate that into your training program evaluations and managing the program. So thank you for helping lead the team to put this together. Thank you for joining us in the Axel studio, informing our listeners about it as well.
Thank you for having me, and we hope that these guidelines serve the purpose that are intended, and we will obviously be relooking at them periodically down the road to make sure that they do.